difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Tasha Robinson,
Scott Tobias,
Rachel Handler,
and producer Genevieve Kosky. This week we're talking about Andrew Stanton's 2012 Mars adventure, John Carter, and The Martian, a Ridley Scott film released last fall that's since been nominated for several Academy Awards. These two films offer the sort of study and contrast we love here at The Next Picture Show. The Martian, like the Andy Weir novel that inspired it, is full of complicated science, but tells a relatively simple story. Boy meets planet, boy stranded on planet, boy has to use logic, knowledge, and reasoning to leave planet. John Carter, on the other hand, is pure fantasy, but creates a world so Byzantine in its intricacies that many viewers found it hard to follow, including us. but the films are united by their heroes. It's not hard to imagine Mark Watney using his intelligence and will to survive to navigate Burroughs Barsoom. Similarly, assuming he had a little more scientific training, John Carter would probably draw on the same resourcefulness to make it off the planet. Is it possible that The Martian is simply a John Carter story for a more scientifically informed age?
I have no way to contact NASA. And even if I could, it's going to be 4 years until a manned mission can reach me. And I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. If the oxygenator breaks, I'm going to suffocate. If the water reclaimer breaks, I'll die of thirst. If the hab breaches, I'm just going to kind of implode. And if by some miracle none of that happens, eventually I'm going to run out of food. So, yeah.
All right, guys, let's back up to my last assertion. Is The Martian essentially a John Carter story for a more scientifically informed age?
No.
No. I don't think so.
I was going to say that, too.
All like, right. Well, we're done here.
No, I mean, for one, it's just Mars. It's the physics. I mean, it's a little bit closer to, you know, Mars.
what they were doing Mars. To be fair, was working with the best scientific information he had.
About the bone density and that sort of thing. It's not that. It actually kind of brings me to my topic. Now, can I just get my topic out of the way now?
Yeah, sure. Your topic.
About the virtues of simplicity. because that is, as you mentioned in your intro, a pretty big difference between the two films. You know, The Martian is not 2001 or Solaris. It's not even Star Wars. It makes a virtue of simplicity. Matt Damon is stuck on Mars. He has to figure out how to get unstuck. And that process is a clear, methodical, problem-by-problem narrative through line that is immediately accessible to us as an audience. John Carter, on the other hand, introduces you to a pile of mythology and multiple timelines and two framing devices before it even gets going.
And a hero that doesn't really want to do anything.
Yeah, there's that too. I mean, and I think, you know, in a way that simplicity is limiting to The Martian, which is, I think such a pure affirmation of the optimism and wonder and intellectual adventure of the space program. But there's something to be said about a film so committed to clear stakes and a clear narrative. And I think John Carter could have used some of that.
You know, the reluctant messiah is one of my least favorite tropes in any kind of narrative. Talk about simplicity. There is something so simplistic and direct and approachable and believable and attractive about a story about a hero who is in the position he's in because he wants to be and has to deal with things as they come. Like Mark Watney has all of these problems to deal with mm-hmm. that he didn't choose, but he's not on Mars because he was dragooned into it or because it was an accident. He's a scientist. He loves being a scientist. He has all of this knowledge that he worked hard to acquire and he puts it into good use. He's such an appealing character compared to John Carter or really anyone who has to spend an hour and a half of the story being convinced to do the thing that needs to be done in the place he's found himself. I hate the reluctant messiah trope so much mm-hmm. because it's like we all know what we want to see. We want to see somebody who is engaged with what they're doing it. Like, how hard is that?
Yeah, and I think it says something. I mean, I'm horribly bad at science, but I understood The Martian very clearly, and I was so confused by John Carter that I had to stop and read Wikipedia to understand what was going on. I felt so much stupider watching John Carter than I did watching The Martian.
Which is funnier because it's funny because it's such a stupider movie.
It is, but I was like, I can't even grab, like, what's a Tharc? I don't understand. What's a Thern? I just was really confused. But
was it just because there are so many different factions being thrown at you all at once?
sense.
Yeah, and I think like immediately they're like Scott said earlier, they're fighting on Mars, and then he's dead. I'm like, how is he dead? This whole movie's about him. Like, I don't understand. I literally turned to my boyfriend. I was like, but that's the title of the movie. I don't understand.
The Martian is good at walking you through some complicated stuff. Yeah. You know, and I think the fact that it is one very simple goal, which is survive and escape, or two goals, I guess. But I think it's easy to relate to. Right. I think there is a virtue of simplicity there.
That said, as much as I do value simplicity, especially in like this kind of linear storytelling where we have a clear goal that we have to get to, and one of these films makes a beeline towards it and the other wanders all over the landscape, mm-hmm. I do have a not so secret love of the complex.
Well, the Martian does lack in a certain complexity.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that does appeal to me about John Carter is, like, as much as I dislike the reluctant Messiah, I like the world around him, you know, and the fact that they do pile on all of this political stuff, I think it's mishandled. And I think you're dead on about the fact that introducing all of this stuff that you don't need to know up front is the first part of the film, and then cutting away from it for half an hour, I think that was just a mistake. But the fact that there are so many factions and there's so much going on, and that Mars is this crazy old world with apparently millennia of traditions, I liked that. I liked the Tharks' complicated, I don't even know, religion, politics. It's all kind of one big mushy thing. I thought they were a really interesting race, and you get the feeling that they've been around for a long time and have built up a lot of tradition.
Well, you can puzzle. You actually find yourself trying to puzzle it out.
Mm-hmm.
You don't puzzle out anything in The Martian. You watch The Martian, and it's over. So I think that is. I mean, so there again, there's the virtue of complexity.
Complexity,
not instead of simplicity. It's just not as satisfying an experience as The Martian is. But one thing I do really appreciate about The Martian is that it's not just simply, you know, a lot of survival tales are about will and about stick-to-itiveness, and there's certainly that here. I mean, there is that will and that stick-to-itiveness, but this is a film that is also makes a virtue of knowledge, of like knowing things and being able to solve problems, and not it's not a miracle that he gets off of Mars. I mean, you know, he does have, there's luck involved and there is will involved, but it's about facing a series of problems and trying to work your way through them one at a time, that getting you off the planet. And that's a kind of, I think, certainly in the America of today, is kind of refreshing, you know, because you're faced with a lot of, you know, anti-science people, or mm-hmm. people who think that prayer is responsible for remember seeing, like, when we had the Washington Post reporter was released from Iran, it was like, oh, our prayers have been answered. None of their prayers were answered. He was released because of diplomacy, you know, from actual hard work from people who know what they're doing, and that is a virtue that I'm happy to see celebrated in a movie like The Martian.
Yeah, there is kind of the feeling with John Carter, you know, he's transported to Mars, and suddenly he's like Superman on Earth. Like, he is suddenly gifted with all of these abilities that he did nothing to earn. And it's a fun wish fulfillment fantasy to think about being, you know, gifted with these powers and being given the opportunity to make a difference in the world via no effort or even worthiness of your own, just sort of as a sheer accident. But there's something really appealing in The Martian about the way it portrays all of this stuff as it's acquired knowledge. It's knowledge that he worked for, and he was specifically selected for this mission because he was, an intelligent, top-of-the-line person who worked really hard to get where he is. He's the right person to be in this situation because he's a really smart, good thinker who put in the time and the effort to know all of the things he knows about biology and chemistry and astrophysics.
Science.
those are all aspects of science.
Whereas Deja Thoris just kind of ran across the ninth wave. Ninth ray. I'm still just boggling.
She built that machine.
Are we sure she built that machine?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, she's a professor.
She's a professor. She's going to get tenure.
Only if she can prove that the ninth ray actually means something. Because there's that scene, oh my God, the anti-science of the scene where she's like, I don't need to marry this guy. I've invented the ninth ray. Look, here's a blue glowing ray. This means we're going to be able to bring back the oceans. We're going to be able to make Mars fertile again. We're going to have crops. We're going to be able to fight the bad guys. And it's like, I don't know about you, but I see a glowing laser.
Right.
Like, show me how a laser makes crops grow.
She didn't get a chance. They destroyed the thing.
Yes, she didn't get a chance, but I guarantee you that the next scene wasn't going to be her pressing a button and then the laser making oceans.
She's making an educated guess. Yeah.
She scienced the
It was a hypothesis. She's going to prove it.
Yeah, there's a whole movie you don't see, which is her like puzzling through stuff like Mark Watney.
It's just her on Mars.
Oh my God, perfectly I want to made see that up movie.
And you know, flowing yet revealing clothing. Right. You know,
under boob.
Yeah.
When we get that movie, can it be called Deja Thoris, Scientist of Mars? Because I would watch the ever living bleep out of that movie.
We're doing a good job with the.
We really are, guys.
We're trying to dodge the explicit tag. So. And speaking of laughing, our collective beeps off.
Speaking of hilarious films. So The Martian won the Golden Globe for Best Comedy, which was obviously a controversial moment. Paul Feig thinks it's not a comedy. He tweeted that comedies are created with the express purpose of making people laugh. Judd Apatow went on sort of a semi-drunken rant at an award show recently about how Matt Damon was screwing them all over.
Yeah, the Golden Globes, when Ridley Scott accepted, he was just like, comedy, thanks. Huh? Okay, yeah. Well, thanks for the award,
great,
guys.
Right. So I personally would not qualify it as a comedy, but it's often very funny. There is a lot of humor that relieves tension. And for me, I think a lot of the humor came from this self-awareness that it was, a lot of people after the movie came out, I can't remember who said this first, but we're saying it was sort of a competence porn. Like, everyone was just so good at their jobs. And that was like the whole movie. Like, oh, everyone's just really great at what they do. And now it's over. And I think that for me, the humor sort of served to undercut that a little bit and make it a little bit more relatable.
Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they sent 68 souls worth of food. That's for 6 people. So for just me, that's going to last 300 souls, which I figure I can stretch to 400 if I ration. So I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist. Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
So, you know, there's obviously a lot of humor to cut through tension and to cut through the drama. Did you guys think it was a comedy?
I don't think it should have been categorized as a comedy. But, I mean, I defended it at the time. Like, I don't know, Ricky Gervais at the Golden Globes made some sneery comments about it being a comedy. And I understand he was playing to the fact that it was in the comedy category and that was inappropriate. But it is a really funny movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A really funny movie is not a comedy, though. It's just a really funny movie.
That is true.
But humor helps. I mean, it's a very entertaining movie. It's the most watchable of the Oscar nominees, I guess, in terms of just something you want to sit down and be taken away by. So in that sense, it works. But yeah, I mean, the humor helps in this, I think, in the way you say it does, to humanize a bunch of nerds. Right?
I mean, it's just so crucial to varying the tone of what could have been a wearying slog in the wrong hands. And I mean, the humor comes directly out of Andy Weir's novel. Like, that character, that tone are very, very much in the novel. But there's so much need throughout the movie. You know, this guy is in danger of his life for pretty much the entire run of the film. Mm-hmm. You kind of, in order to have a rise and fall, you need to release that tension from time to time. And his smart-ass comments are a big part of what does it.
I think that also just sets its character apart from being just sort of a faceless wonk in a way, you know. It's an easy way into a character whose knowledge and competence might be a little forbidding otherwise.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think it speaks to his optimism. You know, even in this impossible situation, he can have some humor and squeeze some humor out of it. And I'm grateful that The Martian is not Alejandro González Iñárritu's The Martian. If you can imagine that. I mean, I think you can imagine a version of this film, yes, where the conditions of Mars, which is colder, I will say, than any of the places where Leonardo DiCaprio and Dom Hardy were.
And they had such a rough shooting on Mars. I mean, it was...
Yeah, nobody even talks about it, but Mars is really cold.
That raw Martian meat, raw Thark. They climbed inside the four-armed ape for warmth.
The ninth ray.
Yeah. He does actually climb inside that four-armed ape.
The ape would be actually pretty warm, I would think.
The thing about John Carter, I think, that maybe people didn't get from the trailers and didn't appreciate because they didn't see it is that it also is a pretty funny movie, too. I mean, I don't think it gets enough credit for being a funny movie. And I think that's mostly in Andrew Stanton's direction. Like, there's a bunch of it in the script. It doesn't really come across so much in Kitch's performance or Colin's performance. But there are bits like the thing towards the beginning where the cavalry arrests him. Yep. And a character played by Bryan Cranston is trying to say, you're really competent and we want to recruit you. And every time he gets three words into the speech, either Carter knocks him out or jumps out a window. And it happens so quickly, and the comic timing of it is so perfect. And I'm like, that's an Andrew Stanton sequence. There's the movie, too.
I know. That was so great. And yeah. I really wish that would be repeated because it's so crackerjack.
There's also just the whole business with the Tharks deciding that misunderstanding when they try to communicate and deciding his name's Virginia and calling him Virginia for the whole film. I don't know. There's a lot of bizarre humor in there. Even the business with Collins and, you know, get behind me, this might be dangerous.
Right. And
let me know when it gets dangerous.
And her first scene, too, where you think she's giving this serious sort of speech and really she's just practicing it and she's kind of like, oh, I'm messing it up, which I thought was really great and humanizing, and that for me that sort of sold the character. And like I said before, Dominic West, I thought was really funny. He's like, why do we have these swords if we're not even able to use them? I just thought he delivered every line he had with this really great self-aware sense of humor. It made me sad that he wasn't there in more of the film. But I didn't think that John Carter was actually very funny. That was my earlier point. I outside of those few bits that you mentioned, mm-hmm. there were not really any laugh out loud moments or any moments where I was sort of impressed by the cleverness. For every bit like that, there was a line that was like, over here, you blind monkey, you know, where I was just like, really, dude?
But we're all laughing at that. Maybe it's just so stupid. You deliver it better than Taylor Kitsch did.
I know. I was going to say, too, that I blame a lot of it on him. I think he's just not funny.
And I mean, in a way, he's the straight man. Like, so much of what happens with the Tharks is meant to be, like, they're meant to be comic, even though they're very, very serious. Mm-hmm. And Willem Dafoe, yeah, I mean, he does have his comic moments. Like, he's a pretty outright comic character in Boondock Saints. He's got some comic chops, but that's not usually where people go to when they think of Willem Dafoe.
You drop in Boondock Saints. Yeah. Oh, have Tasha.
You even seen like that movie? Bombs.
Yeah, I wrote about it for New Cult Canon back in the day. It was one of the few that I slagged, but it's got some pretty hilarious Willem Dafoe moments.
Yeah, and they're all Willem Dafoe
moments.
Is he
the one that slaps John Carter when he takes them to the wrong... Yes. That, I like that. That made me laugh. Where he's like, everyone's at the wedding, obviously. And he just smacks him across the face.
And that's, I mean, it's a great little visual joke. Mm-hmm. As much as I'm not into the big slobbery CGI trying to be a toy super dog, there's a lot of comic stuff that revolves around the dog being able to get everywhere faster than he can, you know, because it's got magic super speed. Like the whole
that's
business really... where he's trying to get
See,
away.
That's funny. Well, you don't like the dog?
That's what I'm saying.
Tasha's not into the
That's
dog.
What I'm saying is that, you know, John Carter has more funny moments than people get credit for.
Yeah, the dog's great. With regard to, though, to the humor in The Martian, a lot of films, you know, no matter what situation you're in, I mean, some humor is going to benefit a movie, I think. I mean, Spotlight's got a lot of funny stuff in it, too. That's not a comedy. You know, the Revenant has a couple of moments of lightness in it. The snow. I mean, he's trying for something there, but I think it adds depth to a movie. It adds humanity to a movie. And you know, the fact that The Martian does it so often and so effectively really accounts for its presence in that category, even though it doesn't belong there.
There's also a degree to which the comedy in John Carter is slapstick comedy. The comedy in The Martian is often very dark comedy, and it's exactly the kind of comedy that human beings default to in situations like that, where things are grim and beyond their control. And I mean, we've seen that whenever something goes wrong with a NASA mission and people die, there is that kind of like really bleak black humor that comes up. And all of the humor aimed at Watney about being a botanist and how he's not an actual essential part of the crew because they've got real scientists. I mean, things like that, that first exchange between him and his former crewmates, that is some bleak, dark stuff. But it not only relieves the tension between them within the film and thus for the viewer, mm-hmm. it is exactly the kind of humor that you could see people going through in a circumstance like that.
Yeah, where they're like, sorry, we left you here. We just don't like you. I thought that was
exactly.
great. Yeah.
Well, I kind of wanted to go back to this question. This relates to your topic, Keith, that I had about John Carter, which is, what about Mars? And what does Mars look like in The Martian?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the production design and kind of to address what you brought up, Scott, is like the looks of Mars. They don't look that different. I feel like the colors are a little turned up on John Carter. The Martian kind of goes for more probably what you'd actually see on Mars. But I mean, the big difference to me is it's a great contrast in terms of how they use their production design, because everything in John Carter is designed to call attention to itself. You want to look at those spaceships, like those weird like hover crafts that are really cool looking, and the design of the aliens and so on and so forth. And The Martian, it's no less designed in a way, but it only works if everything there looks functional. If it looks like the sort of the very utilitarian food package you'd have if you were actually on Mars or staying there. And I think, you know, the ship itself is sort of big and roomy and cool looking, but it also looks like it's definitely a function first kind of place. So, you know, a place, if you were floating through space for a while, it's the kind of space you'd live in. Very no nonsense. And it's, you know, kind of keeping with the rest of the movie, which is a no nonsense, let's get from point A to point B kind of film. So I think it's a case of those two things, where, you know, the production design elements reflecting the overall mission of the film as well.
One of the things that made the production design of The Martian convincing to me is there's that feeling of, you know, everything in the hab space has been thought through. It reads as though they actually like consulted with NASA about like, what would this look like? What would this feel like? How could we package this in the smallest way possible? What would be in those cabinets? But as the film goes forward and survival is the only thing on Watney's mind, he cares less about maintaining these spaces in like the pristine conditions that would be necessary, you know, if you're in space and loose detritus would be flying around, or if you had time to concentrate on stuff other than survival. And just litter built up in the hab. Later, when he's booting everything out of the escape capsule, just the pile of junk that's falling around. I had this feeling of, stop desecrating Mars. You've got these you know, huge pristine landscapes where nobody has set foot before, and suddenly they're covered with crap. And it felt real. It felt like exactly what we would do as a species if we got up there, is just like, we need to worry about like ourselves and our lives. Just huck all of the tinfoil wraps out the window and don't worry about where they land.
And then you get a shot of an alien with like a tear coming
down his face. Looking the over the hill. Yeah. Crying.
But at the same time, one of the things that makes John Carter age poorly for me visually is that it's got that digital world sense of porelessness. Like I really do like the design of the flying machines, much more so when Carter actually gets onto one and you see that it's just this mass of like weird whirling gears with giant gear teeth and things like that. But for the most part, everything's kind of got that digital sheen. Mm-hmm. There was a clip, I think, on YouTube or maybe on demand when we watched the film that was billed as a gag reel. And we watched it. It was actually like roughly 30 seconds of everybody on set dancing in different scenes. But in that, you could see, all right, well, here's the scene where we're walking across the giant ancient plinth of doom. And then the floor starts to light up and you can see it's a giant green room. Mm-hmm. There's so much of that feeling that there's nothing here. Like they're wearing green suits in a green room, making green faces at green things that'll be there, you know, that'll be in existence later. And there's just kind of a weightlessness to a lot of John Carter that didn't do it for me.
One related thing is that I think there's just not a lot of like different beats in John Carter the way there is in The Martian. I mean, The Martian does give you those nice pauses that you would want, I guess, in a space movie where it's like, hey, look, it's kind of pretty, right? I mean, this is, you know, we're on, you know, we're out in space and this is what it looks like. And, you know, it's kind of awesome. You do get those beats in The Martian along with the humor and the other things we talked about. And with John Carter, there is that need, there's that intensity that needed to drive the story forward and not a lot of time for poetry or for comedy or for something else that might give you a different feel for that universe.
I also didn't get a sense of where everything was and how they were getting to places quickly and what was far from what and mm-hmm. just what the hell was going on Mars in general. I kind of felt like I had zero sense of...
This is in John Carter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, in John Carter. Like, I felt like the Mars of The Martian was... it helped that they had maps and that he was, you know, plotting it all out. But I was like, oh, is it like a huge deal that they didn't go to the right city for the wedding, or is it right there? You know, I just had no idea.
Yeah, that in particular, there's that sense of, I mean, we could be 100 miles off,
right.
Or we need to go next door to right. the other city. It's
right. And it's interesting, too, because so much of The Martian is just following him traveling for days and days. And there, you actually know how long it takes him to get from place to place. It takes him 50 days. It takes him, you know, every X amount of kilometers he has to refill and that kind of thing. So you really have a sense of how big the planet is versus in John Carter. I genuinely had no idea if it was like a slog for them to get to the cities or not, or where was Zadanga versus Helium, and, you know, were they next door neighbors? I had no idea.
Well, I mean, how could you be next door neighbors with a city that walks around
you tell
wherever
me.
It wants to go? I wish that John Carter had given us more of a sense of Zadanga. It's like, what does it mean to be on a city that's walking around all the time? We get a couple of these like long camera flybys of like the giant CGI legs of the city pounding, and then we're inside, and there's very little sense of transition. There's very little sense of location to Zadanga itself. I guess I wanted a little more flair. Like, the idea of a walking city is such a pulp novel concept, and then nothing pulp novel is really done with it.
Yeah, they hardly even touch on the, I mean, I did think I just forgot that until you just mentioned it. Well,
as far as John Carter's plot is concerned, there's no reason for it to be a walking city, I guess.
Yeah.
It's one of a bunch of elements that feels like it's in there because somebody loved that detail, probably as
Michael
a kid, like reading the book, and didn't actually have anything to do with it necessarily for the story.
I mean, yeah, you raise a good point. Is people involved really do have a lot of respect for Burroughs, maybe even too much respect in some ways. Like I said in the last segment, it feels like some of the best parts are the ones that kind of veer from the source material. But we should talk about the source material. Natasha, that's something you want to talk about.
Yeah, that was my topic. And you're much more versed in Burroughs than I am. I think I read the first John Carter book a very long time ago, but I'm not really nearly as up on him as you are. I did read Andy Weir's The Martian, and I loved that book. It was one of those books that I picked up and then actually did find physically difficult to put back down because there was just this sense of if I close the book, I may come back and he may be dead. He's on such a tightrope the entire time. And if you had told me, like, I'm not a huge science reader. Like, I like science shows. I like science radio programs. But if you told me that, like, a book where somebody meticulously describes how to break down and create oxygen in a contained environment, I would have been like, I'm not sure about that. But Andy Weir is an interesting author. He kind of came out of nowhere as far as most people are concerned. But there's a podcast that Chicago's local public media station, WBEZ, does called Nerdette. And they did an interview with Weir. And he's just a fascinating, fascinating dude. There was so much science that he wanted to be in this book that he just couldn't find a way to fit in. And there was so much research and work he did getting all of the science perfect for this book. And he comes across as a fascinating guy who really worked through the source material. And then Ridley Scott and his filmmakers really respected it. I was very much not expecting to see the contents of this book on the screen to the degree I did, but they really followed through on it.
I read a really interesting interview, I think that was this week, with Drew Goddard and Vulture. I mean, I'm not going to quote it. It's because it's super long, but basically he was like, we don't want to dumb anything down. All we have is like the sort of intelligence and the science of this book. I refuse to do that. And he was having a really hard time figuring out how to write the scene where Matt Damon is, where he's sitting in the rover trying to figure out if he's going to do the fastest man in space travel thing. And he's talking to himself. And he's like, they're crazy. They're using the word fastest man because they think they're going to convince me. And then he kind of convinces himself by the end. And I guess Drew Goddard was saying that he figured that out, felt like he'd solved this huge technical problem, and went to Andy, and he was like, no, like, no one would ever say fastest. That's not a science term. And so he was like, oh, man, I got to go back and rewrite this whole scene. And he said, oh, no, actually, I can just put that in there. Like, scientists don't say fast. They're just trying to convince me by saying that word, which I thought was really interesting and cool.
They just keep repeating, go faster than any man in the history of space travel.
Like, that's a good thing. Like, it'll distract me from how insane their plan is.
Yeah, I get to go faster than any man in the history of space travel. Because you're launching me in a convertible. Actually, it's worse than that because I won't even be able to control the thing.
And by the way, physicists, when describing things like acceleration, do not use the word fast. So
they're only doing that in the hopes that I won't raise any objections to this lunacy.
Because I like the way fastest man in the history of space travel sounds. I do like the way it sounds.
Well, I'm told, again, I have not read The Martian. I am told that the prose style is not so scintillating in that book. Is that true?
Tasha's not going to like this. But I read about, I think, a quarter of the book and before I saw the movie. And I was enjoying it. I'm enjoying it fine. Then I saw the movie, and it kind of took the wind out of my sails of finishing the book because I wasn't finding it that scintillating of read. I was just kind of gripped by the story and the science and, you know, the character's sense of humor. But in terms of actually, you know, involving me in the ways I like novels to involve me, it wasn't really doing that much. In a sense, I felt like the film got it. The film got, like, what I was enjoying about the book up on the screen. And it kind of, I guess I should go back and finish it, but I haven't yet.
Well, I mean, you can justify that because the two versions are so close to each other. If you've experienced one, it's like you've experienced the other. I mean, I found the book to be...
I wouldn't take that answer from somebody else, but I'm glad. If someone were telling me what I just told you, I would not accept that. But... especially for a book I liked, but I'm glad you're absolving me.
Well, I mean, life is short.
You're very benevolent.
If you're not enjoying a book, don't read it. Go on to the next thing.
I was enjoying it just fine, but, you know, anyway.
But it kind of goes to my just general theory about books that make good sources for adaptation is that, in a way, the most pedestrian material is best for screen adaptation. Like, the least amount of psychology, the least amount of internal angst, you know, anything... you know, if it's really just story, if it's a yarn, like that is a good source for a movie. The Martian kind of struck me as that, just based on what I hear about it, of being not a great, elegant piece of writing, but incident packed, very simply written, you know, thrill ride. I mean, that seems like a much more ideal thing to make into a movie.
At the same time, The Martian, so much of that book is told from Watney's perspective directly to the reader. Mm. I mean, what you're basically getting is like the transcript of the tapes that he recorded explaining the steps that he took. It's him talking to himself to stop himself from going nuts. And Godard did a pretty amazing job, I think, of opening that story up so it's not just a man talking to himself in a way that works really well on the page and not really well on the screen. You do still have some of that. He's talking to a video camera, explaining what he's doing and trying to keep himself sane. And it works within the context of the film. But I think if there had been too much more of it, it would have become a little overbearing. It starts to feel like exposition and it starts to feel like voiceover. And I think they hit the right balance of that. Whereas with John Carter, I feel like one of the biggest drags to the movie was the decision to keep in the whole Ming the Merciless wants to marry Dale Arden, like, plot, because that is so specific to 30s pulp fiction and 30s serials. The evil guy is going to marry the girl unless the, you know, the big feud warrior boyfriend who didn't know her 5 minutes ago comes along and saves her. And that whole thing just feels so... aged and out of its time.
That's a case also, like that Vulture piece that we mentioned before. It's like, yeah, this was fresh and original when Burroughs did it. You know, this was, you know, the source material. I mean, this predates superheroes, but here we have a guy hopping around in a planet that's where he's has gifts he doesn't have on his home planet. I mean, you know, it's worth remembering that Superman did not fly. He leapt. He leapt tall buildings with a single bound, just like John Carter, you know? You know, with so much in the intervening years, it is, you know, a lot of what made this fresh and original does get lost.
But even if nobody had aped it since, I think it would still feel dated. Ultimately, it doesn't matter to me whether she was originally a space scientist or whether she was originally, I kind of suspect in the original, there was much less of that, no, I'm a strong female character. Like, I don't need you to protect me during this 5 minute period where we establish that, and I will need you to protect me from the rest of the movie. Like, I suspect that there was less of that. It feels like a very modern sensibility thing. I guess where I draw the line for it myself is just the whole forced marriage thing adds nothing to the story.
Right.
Like, he's got the powerful super weapon. He's coming to destroy the last bastion of civilization. He's working with the Bene Gesserit to control everybody. Like, it's already, there's already plenty of threat. We don't have to add this weird psychosexual thing on top of it all. And oh my God, the wedding is just, it's such a drag. It goes on forever. I'm also not a huge fan of the here comes the wedding. Like, if she under force says the words I do, like, that'll be the end of civilization.
Right.
You know, they haven't invented space divorce on this planet.
Space divorce.
She's tinkering with it in the lab.
She's invented the 10th ray, yeah. Which is the divorce
divorcing
ray.
Divorcing you.
But yeah. They cut off that. They blew that thing up, too.
So any final thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, I have a super important thought, Keith, which is that I wonder if I can get a job as like one of those people who applaud in Mission Control when things go their way. It's in every, you know, you can always expect it as a beat that you expect when somebody pulls through. And I feel like I got the chops for it.
I've also got a really important point to make about John Carter, which is, why is it when the Tharks capture John Carter, they shave his face? And they don't shave any of the rest of him. I mean, they're all hairless. Why is it that they decide that facial hair is a bad thing for him, having never seen one of his species before? But like chest hair and head hair and who knows what else.
Brazilian.
They can see that the facial hair is not working for him.
It all comes back to Mars fashion.
Yeah, they're like, this is not your look, yep. My friend.
Who wore Mars best?
Yeah, ooh.
If you want to find out or, you know, make up your own mind about that, happily, The Martian is now available on Blu-ray, DVD, and video on demand services. John Carter is available on Blu-ray and DVD and streaming and rental and purchase from most of the usual sources. You can also probably find it for about 50 cents at a used record store at this point. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, you want to kick things off?
Yes, I do want to kick things off. I watched a film called Beyond the Lights last night.
Yay!
Yeah, closing,
say all the women in the room.
Closing the book, finally, on 2014. I liked it a great deal, and it immediately took me back to Love and Basketball, which is a film by the same director, Gina Prince Blythewood. She made it 14 years earlier. And what I like about both movies is their sincerity. They don't have the machinations of a rom-com. They don't have the eye-rolling twists of typical like Nicholas Sparksy romantic melodramas. They're just about two people connecting. In this case, a troubled pop singer and the cop who saves her from a suicide attempt. And while I think the film, you know, I think quite beautifully captures the sense of isolation that comes with fame, particularly female pop phenoms who are sort of in this gilded cage. What I appreciated most about it were just, you know, quiet scenes of two really, really beautiful people just speaking from the heart. I mean, I think that there's such a virtue and almost a lost virtue in romances about just that have no banter, that are just about two people who are trying to connect. I mean, like, that is enough for me. And I think if you take away all of that extraneous business, that's when movies really can move you. Like, and I was moved by Beyond the Lights. I see you, Beyond the Lights. But what about you, Rachel? What do you like?
I would like to echo your sentiments on Beyond the Lights. That movie is the best. And I also have a romantic comedy, drama, people, places, things. It's a lovely little movie starring Jemaine Clement that I feel like everybody sort of slept on a little bit. At least I did. I think it came out a year ago, but it's on Netflix now. He plays a graphic designer who's just gotten divorced from Stephanie Allen. Her name's Charlie, who, fun fact, she's married to Tig Notaro in real life. Catch her in Tig, also on Netflix. Jessica Williams from The Daily Show plays his really smart and really funny student. She sets him up with her mom, Diane, who's played by Regina Hall, who's fabulous. And the film follows him as he decides whether he's going to pursue things with Diane and how he's going to get over Charlie, but the most delightful scenes were the ones where he's figuring out how to parent his twin daughters. Scott, I feel like you would really enjoy this movie, actually.
Okay.
Just this dad kind of trying to have fun with his kids and discipline them and not just feed them pizza for breakfast every day. And it's Jemaine Clement, so he's completely charming and very low-key the whole time. And it was actually just like a moving, sweet, cute little movie.
Yeah, totally, totally not on my radar at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, me neither.
Tasha, do you have a person, place, thing, or film you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, but it's not a romantic comedy, so I feel a little left out. I will, of course, third the Beyond the Lights love. Back when we were at the Dissolve, I interviewed the director, Gina Prince Bythewood, and the star, Gugu Mbatha-Raw. And like, I was just, it was one of those things where I kind of walked in the room like, I don't want to fangirl at you, but I kind of want to fangirl at you. Because there was just something so like raw and emotional about that film. And I really connected with it. Also, it has some really impressive musical sequences and some really interesting things to say about the sexualization and commoditization of women in media, which none of which sounds like a really good sell, but it's super hot people engaging in super sweet romance.
But do you think it maybe edges a little on the prudish side?
One of the things that I asked them was actually, like, I thought it was a little in the opposite direction. I thought they were kind of trying to have it both ways by so openly sexualizing her and then saying, but this is naughty. Like, here are her boobs, but how dare these people, like, want to see her boobs? I think that no matter where they fell on that line, they were going to get criticism because it's so hard to deal with some of these issues while taking a stand that doesn't make you seem like you're going too far in one direction or the other. And I think they navigate it pretty well. As far as my personal pick, I recently got to catch up with the touring shows of the Oscar-nominated shorts for this year, which is always an interesting program because it's always so diverse and colorful and covering such a myriad of like countries and topics and ranges and tones. It's a really complete roster this year. There have been years where they're like, here are three of the animated Best Short nominees and one of the documentary and two of the live action. It's what we were able to get the rights for. But this year, apparently all five Oscar-nominated shorts are touring, all five live action fiction shorts are touring as part of two separate programs. And these are a really strong slate of films. I mean, in the animated side, you've got Pixar's Sanjay Super Team, which was one of my favorite things of the year, way more than The Good Dinosaur, which it aired with. Going back and watching it again was so much fun, but it's actually up against some fairly stiff competition. And, you know, I could sit here and describe all the shorts to you, but what's the point? The point is it's a really strong field of contenders.
Who's going
to
win?
I think Sanjay's Super Team is probably going to win animated. Probably its strongest competition is Don Hertzfeldt's World of Tomorrow, which, boy, that is an interesting both emotional experience and aesthetic experience. I mean, I would be happy with most of these winning. On the live action side, my vote would... It's funny. They're all such sad stories. And it's like, here's a story about Serbian oppression of Albanians. Here's about a story about conflicts in the Israeli settled portions of Palestinian lands. Here's a story about a tragic and horrible divorce. And the one that I fell in love with was a story about a guy that stutters and is trying to figure out how to meet the woman he's been talking to online without making a mess of it. And it's the direction on this piece, Scott, I think you as a fan of actually directed projects would particularly like Stutterer.
So what is it? Do you think, again, what's the name? Because there are crib sheets out here.
It's called Stutterer, written and directed by Benjamin Cleary. I don't know if it'll win. It doesn't have the gravitas of the others or the social importance, but it is, I think, the most beautifully directed and beautifully presented. Anyway, these programs are touring. Check your local art theaters. They may be in town. And if not, look for them online. And that's it for me. Keith, what do you have?
I keep a close eye on what comes out on DVD and Blu-ray because I think I'm, you know, I'm one of the few people that still cares. But I care. I think there are others out there. And Scott, you'll be happy that Ice Pirates came out on Blu-ray this week.
I know. I'm excited. I don't. Boy, that's
worst
that's
film ever made.
Yeah, my childhood right there.
It's not my pick. Another really good one is Hoshi Ashensi Assassin is out on Blu-ray this week. But the one I want to steer people toward is Chirac, which was Spike Lee's film that came out late last year. And you talked about Love and Basketball never going too far in any one direction. And Chirac is a film that pretty much goes too far in every direction, but it's part of what it makes it interesting. It is a attempt to address the inner city violence of Chicago in particular, but also just America in general. And in doing so, Spike Lee and screenwriter Kevin Willmott adapt Aristophanes' Lysistrata, the ancient Greek comedy about a sex strike to end a war, and transposes that to the south side of Chicago. And it's done in verse, and except for the parts that aren't done in verse. And it's a broad comedy, except for the parts that are really tragic. But I think ultimately there is a sense of concern and urgency and just, you know, raw filmmaking talent that Spike Lee brings to it that I don't think it reconciles all those competing elements, but I think it does make it coherent into interesting film. And it's not perfect, but it is I think it's a vital piece of filmmaking, and I would recommend you check it out.
I've had so many problems with his films so often, and this brought me back so strongly to his earliest days when just everything that he made had this kind of like crazy, intense feeling, this energy. And I agree with you. I feel like its parts don't all mesh together, but it's both ambitious and it just feels really very much like he has the courage of his convictions on this one. But what I thought was most astonishing about it was just, I really like the verse. I think that the actors really pull off the like fairly complicated high level demand of talking in this like kind of ancient poetry style. I was really convinced by it.
I'm right there with the both of you, and actually want to offer another pick related to it by Kevin Willmott, the co-screenwriter, did a film called CSA, Confederate States of America, which was a mockumentary that imagined if the South had won the Civil War. It's very meticulously done, very smartly conceived, and super provocative, and very much in that kind of same vein as Chirac. So Willmott is as much, you know, to credit or blame or whatever for Chirac as Spike Lee is. They both are, you know, provocateurs who punch hard.
Yeah, the CSA pick reminds me. I've been wanting to see that movie, so that's definitely one I will check out, and hopefully our listeners can check out some of these as well. And that's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. But before closing the book on this week's episode, let's reveal the movie pairing for our next episode, which will be appearing February 16th and 18th. Tasha, what will we be doing?
For cinephiles, it's always an occasion when a new Coen Brothers movie comes out. Joel and Ethan Coen have been making movies together since 1984's Blood Simple, and films of theirs like Fargo, Raising Arizona, Inside Llewyn Davis, and many more are among our favorite features. It's also an occasion for cinephiles when filmmakers make films about filmmaking and let the rest of us in on how they see the inner workings of their particular sausage factory. The Coens' latest feature, Hail Caesar, does exactly that, with a largely comic look at a 1950s Hollywood studio where fixer Eddie Mannix, played by Josh Brolin, deals with one crisis after another on a long, busy day of production. But this isn't the Coens' first film about Hollywood. In 1991, their film Barton Fink also took a behind-the-scenes look at the film industry, in this case through the adventures of a hapless screenwriter played by John Turturro, trying to overcome writer's block while writing a wrestling movie at a dilapidated hotel. These are two very different films, but we're going to look at the ways they both deal with the difficulties of creativity in the movie industry, especially when it intersects with the hell of other people. Hail Caesar opens in theaters on Friday, February 5th. Barton Fink is available for digital rental on Amazon and iTunes, or you can find it on DVD and Blu-ray.
I got that date circled on my calendar. That's, you know, a new Coen Brothers film is definitely something to look forward to.
Red ink, giant Sharpie.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of John Carter, The Martian, and anything else film-related. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before we close out this episode, where can you find everyone these days? Rachel?
You can find me at Uproxx, Vulture, Vanity Fair, Cosmo, and random other places from time to time, and also at @Rachel_Handler on Twitter. Scott, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter and Peach at @Scott_Tobias. You can also find my writing at NPR, Variety, Vulture, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and Oscilloscope's Musings. Tasha, what about you?
I am a full-time film critic and TV writer at The Verge. You can also find me on Twitter under my name, Tasha Robinson. Keith?
And you can follow me on Twitter at KFIPS3000 and working behind and in front of the scenes at Uproxx.com. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at NextPicturePod or by visiting NextPictureShow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks again to Genevieve Kosky for producing the show. You can find her at Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. And thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. And finally, we'd like to thank our parent podcast, Film Spotting, for all their help, input, and support. Please see you next time, whether you're on Earth or on Mars or Barsoom. There's a star.